it now for free. Just come on down to the shoreline where the water used to be. Now down in the Gulf, east of Mexico way, is something gone wrong?
Day after day after day, the hole in the ocean floor is hemorrhaging oil. At first, official estimates were just 1,000 barrels a day. For weeks, authorities insisted it was 5,000. 2 months later, it has leapt to as much as 60,000. All we know is that the guesses keep growing. But even at this current estimate, enough oil has already escaped to cover every person in the United States in crude, 15 times over.
Die for oil, sucker.
All plastic is oil. Most paints, all pesticides are made from oil. Everything from toothpaste to toothbrushes is made from oil. There are 7 gallons of oil in every tire. There is nothing anywhere in any combination that will replace the edifice built by fossil fuels. Nothing.
Nothing.
Peak oil is probably now very easy to explain, much easier than it was a long time ago. People have felt what $147 a barrel oil feels like. Essentially, peak oil is like if you know what a bell curve is. Goes up, comes down. Peak oil is the point of oil production when you're at the top of the bell curve. And essentially what that means is you've used up half of the resource. But in the case of oil or any other substance like that, no matter how much money you throw at it, you're never going to be able to increase oil production above where it was at peak. You're never going to be able to increase oil production above where it was at peak. As of 2008, the International Energy Agency has admitted that there is a global 9% decline rate in oil production. That's the equivalent of about 8 million barrels a day. There is no way, having plucked all the low-hanging fruit and found the big reservoirs, that we're going to be able to offset a 9% decline rate. From a detective standpoint, if you're trying to assemble a case, you know, the multidimensional aspects of a case, means, motive, opportunity, to understand what kind of force drives events. Peak oil was almost with the stroke of like a diamond cutter's knife, the single piece which started to make everything resonate and make sense together. You will recall that when the Bush administration took office in January 2001, a National Energy Policy Development Group, the NEPDG, was formed and placed under the exclusive private absolute control of Vice President Dick Cheney. Its records were kept a secret. Its minutes were kept a secret. 7 pages were released as a result of 2 lawsuits. And it clearly shows that that task force was looking, saying, how much oil is there? Where is it? Who owns it? They knew that this was coming for a long time. It's been known that this event, this collapse, this crash was coming. First of all, if you think there might be oil someplace, then what you do is you go drill a test well. Then what you have to do is to take that one well in the center and then you drill a series of appraisal wells around that well to determine where the oil field might go. You don't know how much oil you're going to get, how deep it is, what kind of oil it's going to be. There are many different grades of oils, a lot of which are more expensive to refine. So all of that has to do with how long it takes to make something produce. How much energy do you get back for how much energy you invested? When oil was seeping out of the ground in Pennsylvania, you got a return of, I don't know, 200 to 1. When you have to go offshore to deep water, drilling in 15,000 feet of water, and your first well costs $150 million to build, all that's energy that's being invested to get energy. And the moment you start burning more energy to get a barrel of oil out of the ground than it's worth, forget about it. The world's been thoroughly explored over the last 120 years. There's no new major oil finds left. As a matter of fact, no field the size of Ghawar, the largest field in Saudi Arabia, has ever been discovered since. Saudi Arabia has 25% of the known oil reserves on the planet. 25%.
Why, if Saudi Arabia has all these untapped reserves onshore, are they moving heavily into offshore drilling?
Now, if it's 5, 10, 50 times more expensive to drill offshore than on land, doesn't that tell you that Saudi Arabia knows they've got no more oil to find? It's axiomatic that if Saudi Arabia has passed its peak and is in decline, the whole planet is, just because of the size of the reserves that are there.
Light and sweet, and it wants to leap out of the ground.
Die for oil, sucker.
Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours. Their refusal to do so will result in military conflict, commenced at a time of our choosing.
It is now 0 hour.
This is clearly an indication the Iraqis are under the impression that they're under attack.
On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war.
Whether you're for the war or against it, whether the fighting goes smoothly or not, one day the oil fields of Iraq are going to make a difference in how much you pay to fill up your car. Richard Blystone, CNN, Rumaila Oil Field, Southern Iraq.
Iraq is oil that's not only accessible, it's right close to the Persian Gulf, which means it's a short distance to ships. They can put the pipelines, they can get that into the global supply stream as everything else declines. And Iraq was all about the oil. You know, a lot of people have admitted that, and like, duh. 11 days after 9/11, when there was no clear evidence that Saddam Hussein had anything to do with 9/11, of course he didn't, that the plans were started to invade Iraq, of course. That was the objective. Get control of that oil. Because Saddam Hussein had been talking about pricing his oil in euros, taking it away from the dollar. We got in there, we restructured everything, we put in a friendly government using the US dollar, and we assured the oil companies their quote-unquote fair access and fair share of Iraqi oil. We have no intention of leaving Iraq. We're never going to leave Iraq. Going back to 2004, we started building the largest, most permanent military bases, three of them in the world, plus the largest embassy compound that's ever been built. We built an embassy compound in Baghdad that's bigger than Vatican City. That's not a temporary deal. Nobody's going to take that oil, but we are sitting on it. But there is not enough oil in Iraq to change anything. Iraq probably has around 90 billion barrels of recoverable oil. That sounds like a lot of oil. But when you consider that in 2008, the world was consuming 85 million barrels a day, that means a billion barrels of oil only lasts for about 11 and a half days. So that ain't that much.
For a place to attack, why not attack Iraq? They've got coconut and palm oil and crude. They invaded Kuwait, so let's not hesitate. We can blow up a country or two. If it's oil or it's Greece, we don't have time for peace. Waging war is what we want to do. Oh,
I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
Everybody!
I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, be it olive, safflower, or crude.
Die for oil!
For cooking, for cars, take a rocket to the stars, for a background romantic rendezvous.
Die for oil!
On your face, or almost any place, a little dab of oil will get you through.
Die for oil!
I'd go anywhere to fight for oil. It's gonna be a great fight. Should only take a fortnight to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
They knew exactly what was coming. That's what's in the National Energy Policy Development Group report that's been classified, because if that report were declassified, we would be building scaffolds to hang Dick Cheney and everybody in that administration tomorrow. Let's assume, just for the sake of discussion, that there's 600 billion barrels in the Arctic. First of all, it happens to be under the polar ice cap. That's a problem. The polar ice cap happens to be on, what, 10, 15,000 feet of water. The problem with the polar ice cap is it floats, it moves. So you can't drill a well on Tuesday and expect it to be in the same place on Thursday. That's why a lot of conservative think tanks and oil companies are cheering the melting of the polar ice caps. If there is oil in Anwar, there's no more than about a 6-month supply for the entire United States. There are no pipelines across 1,000 miles of tundra that's melting due to global warming, which means you can't sink pipes to support a pipeline in tundra that's turned to mud. There's no tanker routes. The wells aren't drilled, and yet we are spending our future as if that oil is there. We got to drop all this lying right now. If we don't need transparency about anything about other than about how much oil is really left, because we don't know. Oil is a commodity. It's an asset. You make loans based upon what's in the ground. So you have all these accounting terms: possible reserves, proven reserves, ultimately recoverable reserves, verified reserves, estimated. But actual reserve estimates are state secrets. The Saudis don't dare announce that they've passed their peak of oil production. Why? They have a very restive population that have been sold an expectation of a rising standard of living. And the moment Saudi Arabia acknowledges its past peak, it may well have a revolution. Now, what happens if there's a revolution in Saudi Arabia with 25% of the world's known oil? Where's that oil going to get replaced from? It can't be. very complex problem. It's a very complex situation.
Because it's oil. It's oil. And it's creeping in the sea. Oil. Oil. Don't buy it at the station. You can have it now for free. Just come on down to the shoreline where the water used to be. Yeah!
Die for oil, sucker. 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 Die for oil, sucker.
Die
sucker.
For oil,
sucker. Sucker. Sucker.
Obviously, beyond addressing the cleanup of the oil in the Gulf, President Obama's speech had a larger goal.
For decades, we have known the days of cheap and easily accessible oil were numbered. Now is the moment for this generation to embark on a national mission to unleash America's innovation and seize control of our own destiny.
I believe we can fly. Using non-petroleum-based technology, or giant magnets, or hamsters running simultaneously, some other type of energy source that we haven't quite. Now is the moment to dramatically improve our environment and move beyond a petroleum-based economy, unlike in 2006.
This country can dramatically improve our environment, move beyond a petroleum-based economy, and make our dependence on Middle Eastern oil a thing of the past.
Yes!
But see, back then, in 2006, we didn't do it. Because oil dependence had at that point only entangled us in two simultaneous wars. But now, it's gotten us into two wars and a giant spill. That's the push we needed. Although, I don't know, two wars and a giant spill, it's an awful lot to overcome and also do the get off the oil thing. You know, I wish we'd taken care of this energy problem 10 years ago when there was no war and the economy was great. That would have been a great time to develop a long-term energy strategy.
We need a long-term energy strategy to maximize conservation and maximize the development of alternative sources of energy.
And we would have done it too. If he hadn't have gotten distracted by that other spill. Which, I should add, also took 5.5 miles of boom in the Navy to clean up.
That's why they call him the big dog.
If only the guy before Clinton had thought of this.
There is no security for the United States in further dependence on foreign oil.
Yes. And he would have done it too. If it hadn't been for these showing up. Ooh.
Ooh.
That thing could really tow the boat I don't have up the mountain I don't live near. I bet the four guys before him would have gotten us off foreign oil, too, if they had thought of it.
We will continue supportive research leading to development of new technologies and more independence from foreign oil.
This intolerable dependence on foreign oil.
New standby emergency programs to achieve the independence we want.
We will break the back of the energy crisis. We will lay the foundation for our future capacity to meet America's energy needs from America's own resources.
Fool me once. Shame on you. Fool me twice. Shame on me. Fool me 8 times. Am I a f***ing idiot? I must be an idiot. So counting Barack Obama The last 8 presidents have gone on television and promised to move us towards an energy-independent future. Before that, I'm sure they probably did it on radio. Well, why didn't it work? Why couldn't we do it? It's not like they didn't have good ideas.
Wind turbines.
Nuclear energy.
Solar bank.
Energy-efficient windows.
Energy-efficient homes.
Natural gas. Hydro.
American coal.
Solar power. Ethanol, not just from corn.
Atomic power.
Wood chips and stalks or switchgrass.
Fuel cells.
Natural gas.
Zero emission coal-fired plants.
Solar panels.
Better batteries for hybrid and electric cars.
Methanol.
Ethanol.
Plant products for gasohol.
Let's just use oil. You know what? We have to. I will not allow the dinosaurs to have died in vain. So we had good ideas, and we're good people.
We have the world's highest level of technology.
We have the know-how.
We have the ability.
Our unyielding faith.
Worthy of a great nation.
We have the most skilled workforce.
Our resilience.
America is a rising nation.
We are an unstoppable oil dependency breaking machine. Unfortunately, the machine runs on oil. But, this whole thing is maddening. Maybe we just need a deadline, hard and fast, like we did with the moon. In 10 years, we will go to the moon, and in 10 more years, be somewhat bored by doing so. We just need the president to lay out reasonable time parameters.
At the end of this decade, in the year 1980, the United States will not be dependent on any other country for the energy we need.
By 1985.
By the year 2000.
Within a matter of 3 or 4 years, if we'll just get after it and treat this like it's important.
Another great goal, to replace more than 75% of our oil imports from the Middle East by 2025.
So Nixon says, let's get off foreign oil by 1980. Which somehow becomes, let's not use as much foreign oil by 2025. We've redefined success and still failed. Which brings us to perhaps the strangest aspect of this sad, some would say Groundhog Day-ish saga. Of all these 8 men of incalculable power who tried and failed to get us off of oil, one stands head and shoulders above the others as far as actually doing something for the environment. Who? I'll give you a hint. What's got 4 fingers and resigned in disgrace?
This guy.
He created the Environmental Protection Agency. He signed the Clean Water Act of 1972, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, when the Cuyahoga River was on fire in 1969. He put it out with his own urine. But even Nixon couldn't get us off oil. And this was a guy who, by the way, was not afraid to bend the rules to get things done. Couldn't get it done. Because you see, it turns out Nixon had one major flaw. No, not delusional paranoia coupled with living in an ethical netherworld. No. You know why Nixon couldn't get this done?
We will establish a new system that makes high-quality health care available to every American in a dignified manner and at a price he can afford.
Because Richard Nixon was a communist.
The 70s was really a critical decade. In the 70s, Marion King Hubbert, the original prophet of peak oil, in late 1949, he did the math. It said U.S. domestic oil production will peak in 1970. So that's not some feat of Nostradamus communicating with some entity. It's math, it's science, it's simple. But in the 70s, M. King Hubbert testified before Congress. That was 1974. In 1976, President Jimmy Carter said, man, we cannot use as much energy as we have been using.
To use energy more efficiently.
That's when solar panels went up. That's when he started. He knew. They have known in Washington, I have published on my website, as have others, declassified CIA documents from 1976 showing that CIA was perfectly aware of peak oil. In those days, of course, when the situation appeared to be normal, when people had jobs, they had vacations, they had credit cards, they had credit lines. Everybody's talking about growth, 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 buy, 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 spend, consume, consume, and everything seemed to be working. Yeah, we were called alarmists. We don't live in that world anymore.
Americans were on the way to owning millions of cars.
800 million internal combustion powered vehicles on the planet. They all run on oil. It takes uncounted barrels of oil to make those cars and engines in the first place. And you cannot plug any new technology into an internal combustion powered engine. With 7 gallons of oil in every tire, nobody will ever make 800 million new internal combustion anything because there ain't going to be enough oil. Ethanol is an absolute joke. First of all, a very brilliant scientist, David Pimentel, took the concept of net energy. How much energy do you invest versus how much do you get in return? And he concluded about a decade ago, I guess, that it takes more energy to make ethanol than you get from burning it, which is absolute stupidity. Because you drive the oil-powered machines, et cetera, you irrigate, you use the fertilizers, you're burning all that oil and natural gas to grow it. Then you make steam, which is more hydrocarbon energy, you add more chemicals, and you come up with ethanol, which you can put in a car. Now, the Bush administration had announced a goal of having 15% of all fuel in the United States made from ethanol, I think, by the year 2015. They forgot to tell you that that would take all the arable land used to grow corn to do it. Canadian tar sands is an oil. It is a very, very thick, sticky, obnoxious substance that's mixed in with sand at levels 200, 300, 400, 500 feet in layers beneath the soil. This is in Alberta. And they literally strip mine thousands of tons a day. They put them in these huge oil-powered dump trucks and drive them to a place where they then wash the sand. They take millions and billions of gallons of fresh water, which we're running out of everywhere, and they boil it by burning natural gas. There is not a possibility anywhere the Canadian tar sands production will exceed maybe 3.5 million barrels a day. The first thing that the uneducated mind that's in denial says, well, what about hydrogen? Can't we make electric cars? And I have to bring them back to the fact that there's 7 gallons of oil in every tire, that there are thousands of gallons of oil in every car, in the plastics, the paints, the resins, everything, all of that's made by oil, the oil that's used to manufacture the car and ship it around to heat the metals, et cetera, et cetera. There will never be 800 million electric-powered vehicles, and electricity is not an energy source. Electricity is generated by burning or using some other kind of energy.
The fragile ecosystem of the U.S. Gulf Coast. Home to fertile swamps and marshes and the most productive fishery in the United States. Also home to this. Nearly 4,000 active oil and gas platforms. Not to mention the country's largest concentration of refineries and petrochemical plants. In the wake of the Deepwater disaster, the threat posed by offshore drilling to the Gulf of Mexico is on display for the world to see. Less known is that the oil industry has been transforming this part of the world for decades.
This oil is not coming ashore in a robust, thriving, a natural swamp or marsh. It is a marsh that is barely holding on and is falling apart.
It is a place teeming with life, above and below the waterline. For decades, these marshes have hung on in the growing shadow of gas and oil infrastructure. Now, the crude reality of the oil itself has arrived.
You know, like everyone else, I've been looking at pictures of oil on water for weeks now. But to be in such close proximity that I can touch it, in fact, it induces a kind of feeling of nausea. Not just that if there's oil here at this boom, then there's oil way into the wetlands, very likely, but that this is just the tip of the iceberg, that the vast majority of the disaster is still way out in the Gulf, underwater, invisible, still to come.
What have they done to the earth? What have they done to our fair sister? Ravaged and plundered and ripped her and bit her. Stuck her with knives in the side of the dawn and tied her with fences and dragged her down. I hear a very gentle sound. With your ear down to the ground.
Everyone started experiencing little dizziness, headaches.
Working for BP to help clean up the oil spill, this shrimp boat captain isn't supposed to talk to the media, but he's at his wit's end. He's been confined to port for almost 2 weeks with a sick crew.
They were in bed. They couldn't get out of bed. That's how bad they felt.
His boat had been working in water containing oil dispersants. He says he was told by BP to go straight through to help break it up, so he reported his crew's illness to his supervisor, who sent along a medical team.
When they came on board, we all had high blood pressure, and they said, well, y'all gotta go to the hospital. So we've been here for 11 days, just sitting there.
He says BP's assertion that sick crews have food poisoning is insulting, and he remembers a BP representative telling him the two approved oil dispersants are far stronger than widely realized.
Put that in a hubcap, and if you want to kill a cat, let him drink it. The cat's going to die. He told me that himself on this boat. Now they're trying to tell me it was food poisoning? Come on now.
BP says an independent investigation is underway into the mystery illness among boat crews. Incorrect use of cleaning fluid on board some boats is their latest theory, but every possibility is being investigated.
Including heat stress, including fatigue, including psychological stress. This is a difficult situation for all of us involved in the response. Food poisoning was one of the possible explanations. Our best explanation at this point today with the facts that we have is that it might have been caused by this misuse of industrial type cleaners.
In the waters outside the port of Venice, the BP cleanup operation goes on. Workers in protective clothing use skimmers to try to suck up as much of the oil and remove it from the shore as they can.
Doctors say headaches, dizziness and nausea are all consistent with breathing in noxious oil fumes or having reasonably close contact with the dispersants being dumped in the Gulf to break the oil up. But they say they're also consistent with many common illnesses. They say far more troubling is the psychological impact that may beset many families as these fishing communities struggle to cope with the growing impact of the oil spill.
Far away from dry land, and it's bitter now. chains all hung around me will fall away at last. And on that fine and fateful day, I will take me in my hand. I will ride on a train. I will be the visual man.
And the Gulf of Mexico oil disaster is expected to be 2 to 3 times worse than the Exxon Valdez spill of 1989, previously the largest spill in the U.S. When the oil tanker, the Exxon Valdez, struck a reef off the coast of Alaska, it spilled nearly 41 million liters of oil along the coastline in just 3 hours. Al Jazeera's Scott Hadler visited the fishing village of Cordova 21 years after the disaster.
The people of Cordova, Alaska, pride themselves on their independence. The remote fishing village along the eastern edge of the Prince William Sound is only accessible by air or sea. Cordovans are also resilient. They were dealt a near-death blow by the Exxon Valdez oil tanker spill in 1989, the largest oil spill in the U.S. before the unfolding disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. Nearly everyone in this town of about 2,000 has a hand in the fisheries. So when 11 million gallons of toxic cargo flowed into the pristine sound after the tanker ran aground, it cut to the economic bone of Cordova.
The value of the permit is roughly, loosely based on what you would expect to gross in a season of income. And so the expected gross for this particular fishery went from $300,000 a year down to $11,000. And at that point, probably about three-fourths of the 270 permits couldn't even fish their permits. They were just out of business.
The man-made disaster also hit the indigenous Iyuk people, who have fished the sea here for centuries.
20 years ago, there in my family, and it wasn't too far extended, there were 5 fishing permits, and 5 of the men and families were fishing. One is fishing now, and he has no one that's going to inherit his permit.
Glaciers like this provide the mineral lifeline for the delicate ecology of the Prince William Sound, some of which was permanently damaged by the oil spill. Conservationists say that best practices and preventative measures put in after the disaster are not being implemented elsewhere. To this day, oil contamination is still found on the beaches here. In the spill's wake, new U.S. legislation was passed, and millions of dollars went into changing the way oil is shipped out of the sound. But those measures are not widely enforced in the United States.
Unfortunately, the oil industry was able to influence Congress and prevent those kinds of oversight and capacities from being implemented outside of Prince William Sound in the Cook Inlet, Kodiak spill area. And that's one of the big tragic legacies of that legislation.
To the people of the Gulf of Mexico, words of advice from those who went through and still go through the hardship of a massive man-made disaster.
If I had known that 20 years later we were going to be where we are now, and all the misery and trauma that we've been through as a community and as a family, I would probably just cut my losses and get out of fishing.
From one fisherman to another.
You just kind of have to accept it. You're screwed. It's happened. Your whole life is changed around that. So you need to stick together, take care of each other, because, you know, you're in for a long, long haul.
Scott Heidler, Al Jazeera, Cordova, Alaska.
Here at British Petroleum, we understand the huge economic and environmental impact from the millions of gallons of oil spilling into the ocean every day. That's why we need your help.
It's the British Petroleum Look Everyone ICAP the Well competition. If you can think of a simple way to plug this thing, please drop by your local BP and leave a message in the suggestion box labeled, Look Everyone, I Cap the Well. Winner will get a pair of tickets to see Lady Gaga and a $50 gas card. Holy smokes!
Employees and relatives are not eligible. For a complete list of rules and regulations, visit us on the web at lookeveryoneicapthewell.com.
Hello, I'm Tony Hayward, CEO of BP, a company that cares. A lot of people are asking us questions about our next plan to plug the oil plume. Corporate sponsors have offered to help us, like Bounty, who has agreed to make a mile-high roll of paper towels. It is, after all, the quicker picker-upper. And you can help too. If you have any old Star Wars figurines lying about, such as Boba Fett, Chewbacca or Greedo, send them our way and we'll put them in the hole. They're not worth anything after you take them out of a package anyway. Please send these items to this address. Giant hole in the seafloor. Attention, careless, greedy idiots. Gulf of Mexico, planet Earth. Now, who came up with these brilliant ideas? Our top scientists. Let's go meet them now. Wow, look at them. The top minds of their generation. These are the same incredible innovators who thought of the Dome Plan and the top kill method. These are their ideas from today alone. My daddy is very strong. He could probably plug the hole with his thumb. That's a bloody good idea. Get some of the monsters from Avatar to help. They are blue and very tall. They are very tall. We care about you, but we care about cash way, way more.
Cut.
Brilliant. What's for lunch, lads? Champagne, caviar, and lobster. Again. Let's just make sure it's flown in from Asia, yeah?
Thank you.
8 p.m. on a Tuesday night, and a crowd has gathered at the local high school.
What's going to happen is over the next few months, BP is going to be tested to make it right with you for what has happened.
Representatives of BP and the Coast Guard are getting an earful from local fishing captains.
And all we're getting from British Petroleum right now is, we're going to make it right, we're going to do it right. Well, you know what? We don't want to hear this anymore, we're going to make it right. That's what you need to do.
Thank you.
Why are we still spraying this person that BP don't even allow in their home country? This is poisoning our waters. You're killing everything in the waters.
We've spoken before. I respectfully disagree with your viewpoint.
Let me finish.
Okay.
We say it's good to spray to this person. It's good, yes. To hide it.
It's the height of shrimping season in coastal Louisiana. Any other year, all these boats would be out on the water. The silence of the marinas is poignant. A third of federal waters in the Gulf of Mexico are closed to fishing. Henry Hess and his deckhand are preparing for what may be their last shrimping trip. Henry was working for BP on the cleanup. A few days ago, he quit.
They just don't know what they want to do, dude. It's a mad race out there. That one guy got 30 boats underneath his head or 40 boats, and he's lost too. He's just telling people do this, do that, and people's running all over the place. So really, we doing something good, but we're fighting almost a losing battle right here.
When describing the disaster response, BP and the U.S. government project resolve and confidence.
Well, we're throwing everything we've got at this. This is the largest oil spill response in the history of the country.
And we've mounted the largest response effort ever done in the world.
But make no mistake, we will fight this spill with everything we've got for as long as it takes.
But talk to people on the front lines of the crisis and you get a completely different story.
They are fighting a forest fire with an eyedropper, and they're using the same technology they used 20 years ago with the Exxon Valdez spill. And it wasn't good then.
For weeks, we've been trying to confirm an interview with BP to get its side of the story. We've been told that all the spokespeople are too busy with the effort to plug the well. We decided to try again in person, so we drove out to the Unified Command's Joint Information Center, the headquarters of BP and the U.S. government's public-private partnership in disaster response.
How are you doing today?
How are you?
We're press. We're here from Al Jazeera.
Nope.
English.
No press through this gate.
Who do you need to hear from in order to let us on to come in and talk to somebody?
Sir, turn that camera off now.
BP put on a nice, beautiful show in the beginning of this, and that's all it ever was.
I used to think that nothing could be worse than Hurricane Katrina. Boy, was I wrong.
It was just 5 years ago, the last time the Gulf Coast of the United States commanded the attention of the world, as Hurricane Katrina laid waste to communities across the region. But the greatest human tragedy was the flooding of New Orleans. And that was not a natural disaster, but the result of policies, a levee system that failed, and the city's natural storm barriers weakened by decades of oil and gas development. Today, the crude gushing into the Gulf of Mexico is washing ashore onto an already fragile ecosystem and fragile communities just finding their feet 5 years after the great storm.
Oh, yeah, we lost everything we had, dude. Everything. The only thing I didn't lose was my boat right there. And I'm lucky. Because some of them that lost their boat, they still ain't working. They still trying to get the money because they didn't get the help to fix their boat.
And now we're hit by this, which is really the kind of the inverse of Katrina. You know, the docks are there, ice houses are there, the boats are still going to be there, but they're not going to have anything to catch. And they're not going to have their fishing grounds anymore because they'll have been, you know, contaminated with BP's crude oil.
This disaster, so different from Katrina in so many ways, is nonetheless causing flashbacks here. Fishing people spend their days waiting in limbo, reduced to begging for relief from an ad hoc bureaucracy of outsiders. outsiders who are running the disaster response. BP and federal officials making the decisions that will determine the future for local residents. It is all too familiar.
Post-Katrina, you closed our schools because you assumed we didn't know how to educate our children. You assumed we didn't know how to care for and reopen a hospital or house poor people. We just didn't have any money to do it. Post-spill in the Gulf, you assumed those fishermen didn't know how to clean things up. You know, why didn't you ask them?
Our communities, our families, don't have a political voice. We don't wield economic power, and thus we're expendable.
Oil and gas is killing not just the fish in the water and the mammals. It's killing us up here on the land.
We're seeing that, you know, oil and fish and marine habitat don't mix. And it's no longer a situation where you have the luxury of trying to pretend that it can coexist.
We want you to make sure that you stop letting these people get their permits that easy without knowing the consequences behind it. That's what I say they ought to do, and they ought to put handcuffs on all of them.
Stop calling me resilient. I'm not resilient, because every time you say, oh, they're resilient, that means you can do something else to me. I'm not resilient.
The pump does not know when midnight comes. Days are the same to it. It pumps from Tuesday into Wednesday without a halt. Each day, every day, it brings us another 24 hours of progress.
We're pumping out petrol no matter what cost. And now that 11 men's lives have been lost, the price is as high as rig workers can pay. Paying the price for the U.S. of A. A deep water rig called Horizon went down. No way to seal off its pipe has been found. So South Louisianans all wait for to see just what the landfall of this spill will be. People, oil. And it's all you creeping in the sea. And it's oil. And it's oil. Don't buy it at the station. You can get it now for free. Just come on down to the shoreline where the water used to be. Right.